You're listening to The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas. We've just started our fifth season of Man, and we're off to a great one. And today, without a doubt, is another spectacular interview. If I introduce my next guest by name and all of his accomplishments, we wouldn't have any time for the actual podcast itself. So let me narrow it down. The man wins no matter where he goes. If his name wasn't so Italian, most people would probably think he was Spanish. And I have a feeling you know what I'm talking about. It's the coach of Virtus Bologna, Sergio Scariolo. Coach, how are you, my man?
Pretty good. Pretty good, Joe. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. Like I was telling you earlier before we started, I got to see all the veterans last night and all the, you know, all of us old graying guys, you know, at the Real Madrid veterans dinner. It's always nice to catch up.
I was watching into that pitch. I said, hey, I coached this guy. Am I looking that older?
No. The problem with you is you're looking younger all the time. That's what makes me upset. When I saw your age, I'm like, man, he's older than me.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, first of all, obviously, I want to thank you for taking the time out of such a busy schedule with EuroLeague, the Italian League, and obviously family obligations during the holiday season. But I read somewhere, I don't know where it was. I have no idea because I'm always researching different things. And I read somewhere like your schedule 1 week where it was like a double week. Then you had the Italian domestic league games, but you also had the Spanish national team duties. And it was like, when does this guy eat or breathe? how busy is your actual schedule juggling so many different things?
Well, it's a matter of organization, matter of having clear what is urgent, what is important, where you have to put your priorities on. Actually, that week was quite tricky because I was having practice with the Virtus in the morning, with the national team in the afternoon. I just keep one practice in the whole week with the national team the day before the game when we flew to, when we drove to Milan. And then when I get back, I rejoined the national team. And actually, listen, there were two big wins against Milan and Italy. So I'm looking forward to repeat it. If the outcome is going to be the same, I can go also triple turn if you find me any junior or cadet team to practice in the meantime, in the lunchtime. So I take care of my shit as well.
I mean, I'm going to get into a little bit later, obviously, but my biggest question with the national team is, how the hell did you guys win this summer? How did you win EuroBasket? I got to think, with all the accomplishments that we'll talk about throughout the interview, because we'll get started with your life in general, but this has to be one of the biggest coaching accomplishments of your career, wasn't it? I mean, because you weren't expected to win. You guys were losing games by 20. Every time I turn around, you lose it by 20. And I don't know, was it your coaching? Was it a belief of your team, or was it maybe a disbelief of the other teams that said, oh, we're not supposed to beat Spain this easily, and they ended up, I don't know where, or was this a combination of everything?
Yeah, probably a combination of everything. I think that, first of all, from the pure basketball point of view, in terms of O's and X's, probably this year there was the biggest gap between expectations and final result. That's true. So if you want to put it that way, you might define it, right? Like quite usual. But honestly, from a coach standpoint, as you know, coaching is about, team leadership, roles, motivation, personalities, chemistry. And from this specific, plus, of course, there was an exit, the strategies, game plans, and practice, and whatever. From a specific coach, head coach standpoint, I found it way more difficult to find a way to make it work previously when we had so many great superstars and personalities than this time. This time was, of course, much more difficult from the O's and X's point of view. But it was a right in the park in terms of handling people, in terms of making them really commit from day one, not having any kind of jealousy, any kind of concern about their own role. They were all out from anyone, whoever was even calling someone who had been cut before. He was joining the team with a high level of motivation and high energy. So from that specific standpoint, it was I would say even quite easy, honestly.
But I mean, it had to be one of your proudest moments, obviously. But I mean, yeah. it was incredible because I mean, everybody expects you to win with Pau and with Mark and with Juan Carlos and Felipe and everybody else. But this year was totally different. But let's get into what the crossover is all about now, and then we'll get to that part again more. But it's about you and your life. Your dad was a big influence, from what I understand, from early on. You were born in Brescia, and was he a basketball player? Or did he was a teacher, but did he pushed you towards basketball?
He was a teacher, and his class was the first one I saw play in a academic high school competition. Back then, it was his first year teaching. He was still in high school. Then he moved to university, and those were the first basketball games I ever saw. Then he was basically pushing me to do sport. He was not a player. He was liking sport. He was a role guy. He won twice Italian championship back in the ages in eight people role. I don't know what's right definition of that.
The rowing with eight
rowers in a row, actually. So and he wanted me from day one to do sport. I swam, I was playing soccer, I was playing then basketball, at the same time was skiing. He was big sport fan, but never pushed me towards any discipline in terms of this is what I like, you try to, and I try to do the same with my kids as well. I think it's the best way to make them sports fan, not necessarily a sport professional, maybe one of the two will become basketball player, but in general, I think this is the right attitude you got to have as a parent.
Yeah, exactly. I laugh because it said one of your coaches as you were growing up was Ricardo Salles.
Yeah.
And I read that he recognized that you were a fast learner and offered you your first coaching job at 22 years old. Now, my question is, did he see the lack of talent in you as a basketball player?
Well, that was, you didn't need this super brilliant basketball mind to recognize that. Everybody would recognize that. I mean, I was having great fun and I, climbed until getting close to the professional team in my city. But then I got an injury. Back then, of course, basketball didn't lose anything. It was me as a player, quite early at all.
And on top of it, you went and got a law degree also. You went to study law.
Yeah. My family was an academic family. I mean, both my parents were teachers. My dad was a university teacher. My mom, a high school teacher. So there was a no-brainer. I mean, whatever I would decide to do after the degree, it was going to be completely free to choose it. But finish university and get the law degree, which I actually chose after high school, was the minimum required to have a lunch, a dinner, a bed at home. Otherwise, it was the worst. Probably I would have been in trouble.
So I mean, with parents that are educators and teachers, that's pretty much that's expected of you, so to speak.
Yeah.
And when did you decide, okay, this is I have a law degree. I mean, obviously, a law degree is one of the best degrees you could have. you know, as far as if you want to go out and practice and open up your own, you know, business or whatever. But when did you decide to go basketball is the way I really want to go? Because, I mean, you're literally taking a risk there, because a law degree is a little bit more guaranteed, so to speak, of a future and a career than coaching at 22, 23 years old.
Definitely. But my decision was quite early, right after my first year in college. Basically, I started to coach kids and then having fun and making a good thing. And then Ricardo Salas, as one of his assistant coaches, back then there were two assistant coaches. One of those were basically the real assistant coach. And the other one was passing the ball, was a ball, a little bit more than a ball boy. So that was me back then. But the feeling that could be my way, my road into my future life was there very early. So actually, I finished my last university year was like, you know, when you are winning by 20 and you are just letting the clock go, let's move on. Sorry, I had already decided to do. Back then there was a mandatory military service in Italy, so you had to do it. But Ricardo Salas, my head coach, had found me a job as a head coach in a second division team, which was basically composed only for people who were serving their mandatory military service here. So we were close to Rome. We were all together in a place, like in a sports center. It was a great way, by the way, to do my youth as a citizen. And then after that, I signed for Scavolini Pesaro right after. I didn't even had finished my military service, signed as an assistant coach and head of the youth program.
But with the military team, you won a championship. That was actually your first championship, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was a world championship, yeah.
Explain to me, you're in the Italian military, and how do you win a world championship?
Well, because they were organizing a world championship between national teams made of military people, which were nobody was a real soldier. I mean, everybody were
really
players or coaches. But back then, Europe at least, most of the countries were asking to serve during 1 year. Different kind of army can be, you know, the fly army, can be navy, can be the army, can be the police or whatever. And you had to do it. There was no shortcut. And my family, there was a shortcut, the family would never and you get the shortcut. You go, you run your stuff, and you learn how to live outside your house. And we were competing every weekend. We were playing against regular teams who were playing in the, let's say, third official championship. There was A1, A2, B1, and we were in the plus two times during the year, we were regrouping with all the players who were actually playing with their own team, but at the same time doing the military service. They were coming and we're competing against US, against France, against Holland, Germany, and so on.
It's crazy. You never even hear of these things. And I mean, when I started doing your thing, I'm like, he's got championships. He's got titles I've never even heard of, like that one.
You know, because you're American, because you didn't have that mandatory. But the fun thing about American teams is that whatever reason, nobody could be above 6'6", because probably in the army or whatever, you couldn't.
Right, of course.
Yeah. So it was nice because you had only pitched the ball in, post up, seal them. They're small. Actually, they were struggling to compete, but they were way smaller than European teams.
Right. You had success in Pesaro and everybody. And my biggest question here is, I don't know how much English you spoke back then in the 80s and 90s, or how much Spanish, because I know you learned Spanish when you came to Basconia, from what I researched. How does a guy like Alexander Nikolic become like a mentor of yours? I mean, obviously everybody knew who he was that was growing up at that time and people that were coaching, but how does he become a mentor that you've actually confided in and talked with?
Actually, this is a fun story because it involves you a little bit.
Involves me?
Yeah, that is why. I was coaching 42, the other Bologna team, right? And I had a very curious, let's say, very, very funny owner, Mr. Serragnoli. Every day he was coming out with a new idea. He wanted to do something. I don't even tell you most of this idea because we better keep it quiet. But one day he came up with, for example, you had just scored 45 points against Virtus in a Euro Cup, Euroleague champion.
No, coach, come on, give me some credit, man. It was 63.
Oh, 63 against Virtus? Well, yeah. 63.
No.
I went short. So the next day, if I was saying, listen, somebody who scored 63 on Virtus, we got to hire him right away. So let's send a plane there, pick him up, a private flight. Listen, guys playing Real Madrid, man. Slow down. Relax. I mean, I'm not going to leave Real Madrid.
Hey, coach, my bags were packed. You realize that the funny thing about that story is I was, because part of my question was if you were coaching then the other Bologna team, because you know Piero Costa.
Yeah, of course.
But Piero calls me before the game against Virtus.
Uh-huh.
And he says, hey, because Piero was my general manager in Caserta.
Right.
And he says, and he became an agent. So I said, Piero, what's up? He says, we have an offer from you from Fortitudo, the Bologna, the other team. I said, I'm in one of the most important games of the season. We're playing for first place tomorrow. I said, don't call my agent. Don't talk to me. And he's like, no. He's like, you have to hear this offer. And he gave me this crazy, crazy offer. You know, much more than I was making in Madrid. And I said, call me tomorrow, will you? I said, call me tomorrow. I went out, I scored 63. He called me the next day. I said, remember your offer? He said, yeah. I said, double it. And he said, and now I know what you're talking about, your president. And I said, double it. And the coach says, or Piero called me back. He said, I talked to the president and they'll double it. And they flew my wife at the time in a private jet to Bologna to pick out a school, apartments, and everything.
Yeah,
it was a crazy time.
Yeah, I remember they came up and next morning say, "Are you okay with it?" Of course, I am okay, but I'm not sure that the guy would like to leave Real Madrid to come over. But then I don't know what happened. Anyway, this was one of his original idea. Another one was, "Hey, you think that we might strengthen our coaching staff with more assistant coaches or blah, blah, blah." I said, listen, if you want to do a smart thing, bring over 2-3 times during the season coach Aza Nikolic, whom I considered and I still consider probably the most brilliant basketball mind back then or through the ages, and have him stay with me during 1 week, 2-3 times, probably. So observe. Talk to me for practice, after practice.
But did you know him at the time? Did you have a relationship at the time?
Or zero, no? zero relationship. Not at all. And he said, good idea. And the next day, actually, somebody gave me the number of Professor Nikolic, call him over. And honestly, was one of the biggest learning steps I ever made. It came, I think, 3 times throughout the season. Was there watching. Sometimes he wanted also to step in on the floor and teach something to the players. I was like, oh, prof, go in and do whatever you feel you want to do. But it was unbelievable experience. And we kept in touch for many, many years later. We were calling, sometimes I was calling and it was like, Boli. And I was, it was great.
He's it's amazing how many people he's touched and influenced, you know, through through just, like you say, just like little comments, little words, little suggestions or whatever. I never met him. I never had the opportunity to meet him.
Right.
But there's nobody that talks badly about him. You know, and it's absolutely amazing. So from here, you in Italy, obviously successful. And what makes, other than an offer from Baskonia to move to Spain, what makes you want to, were you looking to change, to grow a little bit? Because at that time, basketball was, I mean, when I played in Caserta, that was when Italian basketball was God in Europe. You had all the best American players, Il Messaggero, Roma, everybody, and it was the best basketball around, but that kind of went away a little bit. Was it a move to further your career, to go get an international taste, go be in another country? What was the reason?
The reason why, to broaden my market, basically, because I thought that Italian basketball was slowly decreasing its, value, power, or efficiency, or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And I was feeling that Spanish basketball was on its way up. Actually, my last year in Fortitudo, I went to school here in Bologna. I went to school during 1 year. I mean, the private school, the Bernitz private school, learning Spanish. And during that summer, I met Portsmouth Invitational.
Portsmouth, yeah, my favorite place.
You bet. Alfredo Salazar, who was, general manager, whatever. I mean, Alfredo is always is the chief of basketball operation, I would say, in Baskonia.
But he does everything in that club. I mean, he does that. And his recruiting skills are incredible.
Unbelievable. But look at the team they built up this year. So, we had, good conversations. We got along, and when it happened that Manel Comas signed for Barcelona deep into the postseason, they called me. They asked me if I wanted to join him. And that was a great decision on my side, because it was opening the international basketball for me, and probably no better place to make your first step outside your country than in Spain. And specifically in Vitoria, where they were with a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of desire to climb to the next level.
It's an incredible place to be able to live and play or coach, because you have so much support you have support when you win. Let's put it that way.
True. True.
That's not so much support when you lose. But speaking about, I don't know how it is for coaches, and I know what it's like for me as a player. Like, some of the best memories I have are the most memories I have, I guess, are the worst ones. You know, when you lost that championship game, or you lost the playoff series, whatever. You took Baskonia to the finals. I can imagine what the excitement was. And unbelievably, you lose to TDK Manresa.
Yeah, that was a nightmare, man. We played so great during the whole season. First round playoff, we beat Unicaja. 3-0.
3-0, yeah.
Second round semifinal, Barcelona 3-0. And we went into the final. We were 15 up halftime. Sometimes the momentum changes on a finger snap, and something happened. We weren't right before the end of regulation. We were one down with two free throws. Friend Santi Abad make one. This another one. We went to overtime. And Chichi Gray was at one of his well-known exhibitions.
Right.
And they beat us. Then we won game two. And game three and game four, you probably back that especially. I'm not going to win a game three and game four playoff final in Manresa.
Yeah.
We were immediately out by 15 both games, but they were, getting back. Luis Casimiro was coach there. Chichi Creo, then Derek Garston, Brian Salier, good Spanish player, Vasquez. They had a good team, but of course, after winning the regular season and the first two rounds, the expectation was to win the league. Then, fortunately, the following year, we won the King Cup.
The King Cup.
And we played EuroLeague for the first year in the team history, the long EuroLeague tradition for that team in Europe.
Nobody can actually realize, except for me, because I've lived a game in Manresa, in that court. We usually play there because obviously you're playing in June, so you got a little bit more of a heat and humidity. When I played there, it was always seemed to be like January, February, when it was the coldest place in the world.
It's
such a difficult gym to play in. But how does that, as a coach, how does that make you better? I mean, because you say what surprised me the most when I researched it was the 3-0 and the 3-0, the Malaga, Barcelona, because Malaga was a really good team also. It wasn't like you skipped through a bad team in the first round and then you got Barcelona and you surprised them. You guys dominated that game. As a coach, what's the learning process in that? Like you said, there's momentum could change in a moment. Like when I'm commentating games, I could see someone dive on a floor down by 15, and you could almost call that moment where you feel the momentum change. But how does a coach get better from that? What do you learn?
During the playoffs, playing every basically second day, you always need to find a balance between keeping your eyes on the spot, on the game you have at hands at that moment, but also in the midterm, because you don't want to have your players burn, game three when probably it's going to be money time or 3, 4, and 5 or whatever. But probably from my personal standpoint, my take was that you got to really give a priority to win that specific game. And don't think too much on what's going to happen 2 days after or 4 days after. Just if you need to play your guys. And actually, I learned it. Also, I strengthened my condition at that point in the NBA, during the NBA playoffs. And you might see now they play with 7 players, 8 players. Right. Play with 42 minutes. So when you get there, you don't have to do it too early. Because if you do it too early, you will definitely end up having your best player burn at some point. But when you reach the finals, that's the time to put there all the meat in the pan or whatever you want to call it.
The oven. Yeah.
Cook the best play you can cook or whatever you have at hand.
It's funny because when you began coaching and when I was playing, it was the preseason determined the 7 or 8 guys that played throughout the season.
Yeah.
And now the preseason and the season are pretty much the entire season's almost like a preseason for the playoffs and the final four.
Yeah, especially in national leagues. In EuroLeague, not that much. EuroLeague, you got to start from game 1, really, really.
Right.
Yeah, especially if you are not one of those top 4, 5, 6 teams who can really think like you said before.
You make the typical move that I made also. You go to Baskonia, you're successful in Baskonia, you have a great 2 seasons in Baskonia, you win the King's Cup, you win whatever. And of course, who else comes knocking on your door but Real Madrid, right? That's usually how they do it. That's how I got there. I beat up Real Madrid a couple times as a player in Victoria. We knocked them out of playoffs. I'm like, hey, let's sign this guy. Is that for you, Baskonia, with all due respect, I played there for 3 years and I love everything about the city, about the team, about the club, and I really didn't want to leave and come to Madrid, but everybody ends up falling for that, into that trap, But as a coach, is that like now that's a pinnacle, here in Europe?
It is probably, but trying to have a flashback, I was very happy, in Victoria, very happy with the team, very happy with the organization. So I was honestly not even remotely thinking to leave. Then this offer came up and was like, okay, I am Italian, I'm moved to Spain, That was my first year. So I didn't even know how many years I would spend in Spain. So back then, the odds were that I could stay there for a few years, but probably go back to Italy. So I felt like, okay, this is probably an experience. It is worth to do, because maybe I will not be able to do it anymore.
Right.
So let's try it. Let's do it, and see what happens. And actually, it was worth, because it's quite different situation, the atmosphere, the team, the club, the fans, the perception all over the world about the team and the club are quite unique. So I did it, and cannot say that I regret it at all, because I had great years in Vitoria, and professional coach is always moving from one place to another one. But honestly, I felt that like it was a much tougher decision to say in another word, a long story short, than you might see it from outside.
Mm-hmm. You kind of came in. Well, it's funny how we're sitting here talking, and I'm putting together the pieces of how we just missed each other in Bologna, and also here, because you came right after I left.
Right, right. I'm chasing you, or you're chasing me.
Yeah, one or the other.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to play for you, because I would have probably won another title somewhere along the line. But it was a difficult time in Madrid, because you know, the end of my time here was a strange time. The club seemed to be going in a different direction, and then from the time from you left, you won the Spanish league title, you beat Barcelona in like a fifth game playoff, and from the time you left, they never seemed to like really focus as much on basketball as they have in the last decade, so to speak. Was did you feel that while you were there? Did you feel like they weren't really focusing enough on basketball itself?
Well, it's out of question that say top management of the club was soccer oriented.
Right, of course.
And I probably might say that even if the interest and the love, passion for basketball grew a lot during this last 10, 12 years. Of course, it's still like Real Madrid Club de Football. That this is out of question. But at the same time, when I got in, I felt that there was a will from within, from the president, the son of the president, to try to do something different, something better, to compete against Barcelona. Real Madrid didn't have won a league. Didn't win the league for five straight years right before. The guy win EuroLeague was huge, but the typical rivalry between Real Madrid and Barcelona was actually in a tough spot, because Barcelona.
Coach, I know. I was part of. I won one of them, but I was part of a couple of the losses too.
yeah. So that feeling was like, okay, let's try, but without making any crazy step. So there were like little adjustments. Actually, we were able to build a good team, which was not great, but became very competitive after we acquired Sasha Georgievich, who was. Mm-hmm. Cut from Portland in around November. So that was a quite important step forward. And it's true that the biggest jump forward happened when Florentino Perez started to love basketball,
right,
and to feel that there could be back in time where Real Madrid was really admired and ended and seen as a top club in the world. Or in both sports, that could have been the case. So he got passion people around him, like you know the actual managers were really supporting him. This and then, of course, the investment and the effort they did in the last 10, 12 years has been amazing. But of course, well rewarded by lot of titles, lot right. of championships.
You actually got to do the. You coached the first ever EuroLeague game that went on at FIBA, which is the Olympiacos Real Madrid game.
Right.
That's
right.
That was
Coach Ioannidis.
Ioannidis.
Yeah.
I missed him. I missed him by 1 year when I went to Greece. I've heard a lot of good things about him.
it was a nice game.
Then you went five years in Malaga, which now, of course, is pretty much your home base. I know you have a place down in Marbella or something with your family. You live with Blanca. We'll talk about her as this goes on also. But in Malaga, for me, those 5 years had to be, for you, almost the most gratifying, because you did kind of what I wanted to do, my idea in Baskonia. Well, you did it in Baskonia also, was, you know, take these teams that aren't supposed to win championships and help them win championships. And then what you did in Malaga between winning the King's Cup, the Copa del Rey, a Spanish league, and you actually got Unicaja Malaga. I don't know if they were Unicaja at the time. I don't know what the name was, but you actually got to a Final Four in the EuroLeague too. Now, my three teams in Spain were Malaga, Victoria, and Madrid, like you, because the fans are crazy. I mean, that must have been an incredible 5 years for you to be in that ambiance of winning and giving a community and a club everything that they've always asked for, you know, always wanted.
Yeah, right. Probably get there at the right time. Boža Marković had done a wonderful job before leaving. I mean, he set the ground to have someone else to step in and to make, you know, the ultimate quality jump. And I didn't get there. I was hoping to go there during the summer after I left Real Madrid. Didn't work. But after a few weeks into the season, they called me up. I remember I was in New Jersey following the Nets training camp back then. So I came back. I had my wedding coming up in November 20th. So it was kind of the last thing, that specific moment I was thinking of. And the team was last. Was at the bottom, very bottom spot. Very bottom or second from the bottom. So I found a kind of a very disappointed, nervous, confused situation where people were supposed to have done their best effort to build up a winning team, and they were catching up themselves at the bottom of the ranking. So it was quite tough at the beginning. It didn't happen in a snap, but step by step, we got better, and we end up making the playoffs and ending up in the EuroLeague, winning another legendary Game 5 in Valencia. We were getting blown by 20 in one, Game 3. We were barely winning in Malaga, like overtime or 2 points, and then we win there. We play 40 minutes zone. Now this is at the subject which is has been quite actual, right? In the last days here in Europe, we played 40 minutes zone, and they got nervous because we were 14 down at the beginning of the second half. And I was like wondering, what did they do?
Wait, but you went zone from the start of the game, or when you went when you were 14 down?
From the start of the game to the end of the game.
And when you're 14 down, you still stuck with the zone.
We were 11 down or 12 down. We went to 14 early the second half. I said, what can he do now? Should I? Because I was feeling that they could probably end up paying. But the time for getting the reward was not coming. So I was quite starting to get a little bit, I would say, doubtful about.
Right. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Of course, but I say, listen, let's take a couple of more actions. They miss a couple. We made a couple of buckets, and they start to panic. They start feeling the pressure of having to win a game five at home, and then we end up winning by 50 in basically 10 minutes. Well, so one of these crazy memories, which I actually came up to my mind in those days, like when we had this nice, chain with Mike James after the 40-minute box and one with Alba Berlin, and we had 3 minutes box and one against Maccabi in the last game. So was sometimes things happen because people react not in the best way. I mean, when you do things, sometimes you are hoping for the opponent not because of the let's say value itself of the decision you made, because of how the opponent will take it and will be able to face it and to react to it.
You know, one of my favorite questions for coaches is, of course, Malaga decided to invest some more money and get a good team. But what's the better accomplishment? Getting a good team, getting a team with a big budget? And I know I'm not going to ask you what's easier and what's harder because I kind of know that answer, but what's the bigger accomplishment? Getting a big team with a big budget where you have a bunch of personalities and winning with them, or taking a team like Malaga and kind of putting those pieces together and playing with a smaller budget and winning and becoming a winning team? As a coach, what's like, what do you, because a lot of people would say, oh, well, the bigger budget obviously is the bigger thing because you may win more, but it's a lot harder to deal with those personalities. Definitely. Than it is form a smaller team.
Well, that was exactly what I was saying before about the national team. Not talking about budget, we're talking about talent, say.
Yeah.
Well, definitely.
Personalities.
Personality. Definitely, as you know about this, right?
Yeah.
I had some good common friends who could tell me stories about personalities back in that day.
Not that we could talk about those here.
So listen, you will be more rewarded when you have a lower budget team and you would bring it to success. But honestly, I can tell you that it's probably more difficult the other way, the other option, because handling the pressure, which is not only and probably not at all your own pressure, but the pressure is on the player. Sometimes will make them become a little more selfish, a little more tense, a little more caring for their own performance, because they feel the need to correspond to the team investment and to pay the each of them back for what they. So that's from the handling point of view, it's a way more difficult situation. When you are an overachiever, when you start from the bottom and get up, the way is like when you play golf, right? If you are in a putting green, way easier to putt uphill than downhill. Downhill, you go too strong, you will end up outside the green. So uphill, it's good because we are going uphill, right?
I don't know when you have time to play golf, but if you do, you it's a beautiful place in Marbella to play golf.
But
also when you go uphill and you put the ball by the hole, you have to come back down also.
It's true. That's why you better leave it a little short that you have two pass, play safe, then you put a second one in.
How before I get into the national team and everything, as your philosophy as a coach, because I mean, all coaches have different philosophy. I've talked to so many different coaches over the years in the crossover. You know, and Xavi Pascual one time told me about how, like, you know, some coaches never want to be, in my mind, it's like if you're an assistant coach, you want to be a head coach. But he told me, well, some people just want to be assistant coaches all their life, which kind of like opened up my eyes to different things. But to me, my question to you is, you've walked into so many different teams. Now coming up is Kimki, Milano, Baskonia again. You've gone through all these teams. When a coach changes a team from one team to another, obviously you have to install your philosophies and your way of thinking. But Does that change based on the personnel? Does that change based on the players? Is it more important for you to adapt to the players or for the players to adapt to you?
Well, it's not easy to answer in a few seconds. I would say that there are a few principles, in my view, which are not negotiable. And this is not my philosophy. This is, I think, how the game should be played the right way. How nowadays the competition requires the game to be played. Like, you got to really be available to play along with other teammates, to share the ball, because nowadays defense will be able to shut selfish, even if extremely gifted player down, much easier than before.
Right.
So first of all, you gotta feel the will to play along with together with your teammates. So share the ball. And second one, you gotta share a will to play deep. Then of course, I cannot say that I can demand the same level of defensive efficiency from every player the same way, because this would be stupid. Exactly the same as I cannot ask for the same offensive efficiency to everyone. Same. It's not possible. But I want to feel people who really try, who really find a way to contribute, who are interested in game plans, who are interested in understanding the coverages, the philosophy, what we want to do with it. So those two principles, I would say, are non-negotiable. I mean, I could barely coach a player who are not really into this, committed into this. Then all the rest, you can have more or less flexibility according to the room you have to pick a player, because sometimes you can have some you know, wider rooms, another time you gotta just try to make the best of it, right? So that everything else can be quite flexible, and I try few of several years ago to keep my ego under control in terms of I don't need to see in every single possession of the game reflected my taste or my ideal of basketball. Otherwise, I will get mad. I will sub play. I want to be stubborn and I want to be not flexible. It is about those two principles. Everybody else, I would say, is quite negotiable.
What's the difference now that you've answered that question, and I think in a really good way, because I mean, you have your non-negotiable aspects of your personality and your mentality, and then everything else is kind of like you kind of deal with it. But what's the difference? And I want to use these two teams because most people have seen these two teams. What's the difference between coaching, you know, your Spanish national team of 2012 and a 2022, for example? Because obviously we're talking about, you know, I mean, you had Rudy Fernandez, who was this year was a valuable lead. His leadership was, for me, he was the MVP of the tournament because of what he did. I always call it intangibles that Rudy brings to a game. But dealing with Mark, with Powell, with Felipe, with everybody else, and now this year dealing with a bunch of young kids that, like you say, they're probably much more dedicated. I mean, everybody's dedicated to the product and the end result, but these young guys even want it more. So there's a whole different way of dealing with those two teams. How'd you handle the difference?
Well, actually, 2012 was my fourth year with the national team and the Olympics. I had already decided to step out and because the 4 years coaching national team and club team is quite a tough, stint. So I had already decided to move out. But still, we were feeling that our generation was the golden generation was at its best. And that was blessing because we had many different offensive options, but at the same time was kind of making it a little bit more complicated because you have only 40 minutes for each position. You have five plays on the floor, you have one play call for any possession. If we call a play for one player, hard to play, call it for another player. Everybody was really all in. Everybody was on board. Everybody wanted to win. Everybody wanted to really make whatever it was in their hands to make the team win. At the same time, the habits of the different group of players were different. So the first group, there were players who were basically the go-to guy in every situation of a different club team they were playing. And they were having 30, or in the NBA even 37, 38 minutes per game. Right. I had to put players who were this kind of players into a role player spot and giving them 7 minutes, 10 minutes, 12 minutes, and still trying to make them feel how important was that contribution. So that was extremely demanding from this point of view. With this team, they were not really coming from being the star of their team experience. They were basically good complementary players, letting alone a couple of cases. They were players who were barely played, like Juan Chambinley had a poor playing time season before. Other players were coming off the bench in their club teams. Like Rudy was as you said, unbelievable example of leadership. But in Real Madrid, I don't even know if you reach the 15 minute per game. And so we had to do the opposite. So make right. this guy believe that they could step up and become the go-to guys in the even if we could look absurd, right, from the outside. Like, hey guys, don't have that position in their teams. How can they have it in the national team? But at the end of the day, it worked because everybody was really putting their best from the defensive end. And offensively, things follow. So people started to believe that they could score, that they could, within a team system where people were passing the ball to each other and play together, easy shots were happening every now and then. So people were feeling like, okay, I can score. So next time I would pass it. Next time the ball will get back to me and I will score again. So it was a nice chemistry, a nice overall atmosphere of team together.
So you're saying other than a law degree, you have a psychology degree also?
Listen, I prefer to read a psychology book than a novel, honestly. Because I think that this is a huge part of my... And even sometimes I get quite against some of the psychology principle, because the time when you speak to psychologists, they forget that this is not an individual sport. So the concept that you get to make the best of each player is very theoretical. Here, you get to make the best of that team potential, because it's impossible that every player play up to his best potential, because otherwise there would be games with the 600 minutes, positions where you have three players playing 40 minutes, having 25 shots per... I mean, this is impossible. You got the chemistry goes by sometimes doing something which is not, say, from the psychological point of view, exactly correct, but you sort of like, listen, this is what it is. Take it or leave it. I had to make the decision. I know that you might not like it, but you will like it probably next time, hopefully. And if not, you got to be ready to like it the third time, because this is what it made me to make decisions.
You know, your answer to that last question, and I love the reason why I love to do these interviews, because especially with coaches, because I always learn something, you know, from listening and paying attention to what's going on. And the fact that you were able to take a team with Pau Gasol, Juan Carlos Navarro, and make these guys believe that 7 minutes was enough for them to be part of the team, And then to go to people who didn't even think that they would ever play 7 minutes in a national team and convince them the total opposite, that you're worth these 7 minutes, and get out there. And you saw your team build confidence during the summer. I was watching the games. I was actually in Greece during the last couple rounds. And you saw your team going. Do you remember a point over the summer where you just looked at your team like, yeah, I think we could really win this?
But that night before the finals.
The night before the finals.
Honestly, it was like, no, I wasn't even, I couldn't even say, well, at the beginning during preseason, as you were saying, where we, at some point we were losing by 20 against Greece after the first quarter in Athens, the very first exhibition game.
Right.
I was feeling like, oh my God.
But this is going to be a long summer.
Long summer. And then against Lithuania, we were getting down by 20 in the first quarter. We played a friendly game there. We're like, wow. But, you know, sometimes the competitiveness, the chemistry, the collective pieces get in place when the competition starts. When you get into the real, hey, we gotta really, you know, give our best. And that's always the hope I have with the Spanish national team, because I always feel that we will be able to multiply on the floor the sum of the individual talents put together like separated. You know, there would be factors there which would make our team collectively better than what it might look if you just consider the amount of individual talent one after the other for separate.
When I look at you and I look at all the stuff that I've researched here and everything I've seen, I think you probably think the same way most of us think. You know, we all, as athletes or coaches, we all have to have some sort of bravado about us and think that we're the best. But we also have to know that, you know, I was lucky to be in the right place at the right time many times when, you know, to play at Real Madrid. You went to coach for 4 years in North America, in Canada, which was right across the border from Toronto, right across the border from where I was born and raised in Rochester. And the first year you get there, you win an NBA title. Come on, there's some luck involved, isn't there?
Oh, definitely. Without luck, I think even
we'd be nowhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Even to avoid two bad things to happen, that's luck. Because many bad things happen to many people who can deserve the same success as you do. But I keep it very clear in my, apart from jobs, I keep it very clear and very, very present in my mind. I got to be very grateful. People say, talk about the hard work, the many hours, the passion, all the stuff, which I also feel, I don't want to be a false modest, always feel that I really commit myself to my job and to my sport. But there are many people who do. And I think that you got to keep in your mind that you got to be grateful. You got to be grateful, players, owners and managers, to the people you have around, your staffs. Sometimes you are the visible face of a success, but never ever forget those many people who are behind, and keep being humble, keep being grateful. Don't think that you are more than what you are, because that's probably the first step towards failure. Just enjoy what you have, and don't be too greedy or hungry. I got to do what you have left, what you wanna win. Listen, let's have a good practice tomorrow morning. And get out of the practice with a smile and with satisfaction of having done a good job. What you want to do most, but then do your best to prepare and to compete and to play in the game. The world will not end after a loss, or war will not make you a god after a win. And what is going to be more or less the same after a win or after a loss? So just don't take yourself too seriously. That's something I keep very, very clear in my soul, in my mind.
And that's difficult for a lot of athletes to you know, to go by that philosophy that, you know, one of my favorite comments was always, you're only as good as your last game, you know, and every day is a new day. And yeah, as I've gone through life, I've learned to kind of like like keep this even keel where like I go back to the 63-point game I scored. I remember the 63-point game, but what I remember more is the following Sunday we had a game against Barcelona. I scored 19, but I was 4 for 17 from the field.
Yeah,
you know, and that's like the rude awakening, you know, like you know, the 63-point game didn't give me anything at that point except for a victory that night.
Well, but, you turned down a great offer. That was up to you, mate.
Man, I'm telling you, believe me, Coach Blatt, when I talked to David Blatt years ago, he told me the same thing that I almost signed with him. I'm like, man, I would have loved to play for you guys. Not that I had bad coaches, you know. Playing with Šelko Obradović was quite the experience, to say the least. And Šelko taught me a lot personally also, off the floor also, which is, you know, I'm eternally grateful to him. But tell me about I don't want to get too much into your Toronto time because it's 4 years of your life, so it's pretty important. But what for you was first the reason to go? I mean, most coaches go because they want to learn, they want to expand their horizons like you maybe did when you came to Baskonia. But also, I want to know what you saw, what you see about what the difference is between an NBA player and a European player. Not talent-wise, but I'm talking about more like the treating, the way to get along, the way to, you know, because there's so much more in the NBA that's outside of basketball that influences a player's life. And what's the difference between the two places?
Well, first of all, the reason why I moved there was basically because I wanted to get rid of these podcasts of agents, media, managers, fans, pressure. I just wanted to commit myself to the game. I just wanted to say, listen, I am tired of this. I need to stay just diving into the game 100% without any complications, any extra stuff, any, you know what I mean? Just pure basketball. Just go to practice, study the game, analyze the game without having to commit any extra time to anything which is not exactly specifically the game itself. That was my main reason. I learned a lot, and definitely I learned a lot from two point of views. First of all, was a kind of a humility experience, a humbling experience, being in a league, in a players' league. You can feel that. That's a player league,
yes.
Especially if you have superstar. If you have superstar in your team, and you got to find a way. It's challenging because you got to find a way to be respected. I remember that during the first month, I think Kawhi didn't even say hi, or maybe say hi. During the playoff, he was coming by before every game. He wanted me to sit down with him 10 minutes and go through every aspect of the coming, upcoming game.
Right.
So to tell you the evolution of the relationship. But at the beginning, it was like, wow, Kyle Lowry now is one of my, I'm saying, best buddies there. But at the beginning, it was like, wow, this guy is, let's say, weird to say the least in terms of how he wants to show his status into the team. Early. And he's a lovely guy. So you better feel that it is not like they can do whatever they want. And it is not like I can do whatever I want. It is fine on a daily basis, finding a way to feel, to understand what is doable, what makes sense, what can be accepted, which kind of awards you got to find to make this kind of people understand why you are proposing them that. Find the right timing, and having the feeling also very last second take something off. You feel that situation has changed. You got to be much, much more sensitive to the player's atmosphere, to the team atmosphere. You're coming from a back-to-back. You're coming from 5 and 7 days. You it's not the same like you have 3 days between game and game and you can put stuff in. Or, you know, it's like being extremely attentive to the feeling, the team feeling, the player's feeling. Then it is to coach without overloading. And that's the main principle in the NBA. Of course, you got to be able to coach using different tools and using different loads. So you cannot kill them you know, running up and down during 2 hours between a game and a game. You got to find a way to work, for example, without body contact, at the same time working on coverages, working on drills, working on 3-on-0, 4-on-0, 5-on-0. Find a way to coach without overloading. And this is extremely helpful for me now in this kind of a season with the team. You have a very tough season. It's true that you have a quite deep roster, especially in some positions in our case, not in others. But at the same time, at the end of the day, the players who will make the difference will be, you know, 3, 4, 5. So those guys cannot be overloaded. We had to take care of them. We cannot get in that red flag area where the injury risk is high. So coming from that experience, for me as a coach, makes my job easier, because I don't feel that my ego, desire to coach, or my feeling that if I don't make you know, ass kicking practices or crazy heavy practices, I'm not really coaching. That's tough.
Yeah, man. I always, when I hear coaches talk about that, and I hear that like Željko Obradović is coaching, you know, is practicing one time a day, it makes me feel like I wish I was born now and I was playing in this age.
Man, you had way less games than your body's here now.
Yeah, we had way less games, coach, but we practiced a lot more than anybody else does now, man. And practices True. Games were easy for us. Games to me were like a day off, you know. It was like, man, no double practices, no weights in the morning, sprints and running, and then, you know, all that other stuff. But it's a different time, without a doubt.
Right. Yeah.
But I like that philosophy is carried over in a way to the EuroLeague, because now after 4 years of NBA, you took yourself away from the responsibility. And you stepped back, became an assistant coach. You said you kind of divulged yourself into basketball. You learn more, and then you decided to come back and get back into it again in Europe. That's pretty much the question. I mean, why? How?
The time was weird, because I had just signed my new three-year extension, and I had a meeting with Masai Ujiri, which I consider a brilliant mentor, even if we didn't stay, you know, too many years together. Was an unbelievable high-level leader. He was kind of expressing me consideration for my future, you know. But at the same time, I was feeling the desire to go back to a head coach job, to also implement what I had learned. So after 3 years of really working hard and having the great joy of winning an NBA ring and playoff, being in an unbelievable organization. I mean, NBA, it is worth be there for a few years. Definitely. I would recommend it to anyone. But at the same time, you feel like, okay, now it's time to put on place and in action what you learn. And this interesting offer came up, and I remember that at the night, which was before the day I decided it was the day to make my final decision, was the only sleepy night I missed.
Right.
Probably in my last 20 years, even before a game or after the game, I couldn't close my eyes during the whole night. And then after making the decision, I felt like, hey, that was a no-brainer.
Yeah.
But honestly, it was tough to come back. The main reason was the feeling that I needed to go back to a full-time head coach position, both with the national team and with the new team Virtus here.
One of the constants that I see in your resume, so to speak, your resume, because you're still young. I mean, really, you're still young to everything that you've done. And one of the things that I've noticed throughout all this is your ability to take teams that aren't, maybe let's not say not supposed to win. I mean, you've had teams like, you know, the Spanish national team with Gasol and Juan Carlos and everybody, but you also had teams like Malaga, Baskonia, that really love to win, want to win, but aren't really expected to win. And you did the same thing here in Bologna. You come into Bologna, and the first year you in 2022, you won the Euro Cup. The accomplishments, I mean, you have some men, I'm going to read them in a minute, but is that a big one? Because you came back from NBA and you said, you know, this is what I want to do. And in the first year you win the Euro Cup, and then and now you're in the Euro League, and you're right where you want to be, almost, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a new readjusting, and now this way back before when I went there, I was bringing some ideas, and they wanted me to bring over some European concepts or part of my personal ideas or in general what we mainly do in Europe. This time was go back to Europe and see what it could work from there, along with the main base of my knowledge and my philosophy, which is of course deeply European. So it's this series is a even of course more difficult challenge because we are new in EuroLeague. Most of our players never play you. They can be better or worse. I don't get into that. My players are always the best in the world. But honestly, many of them were their first EuroLeague year ever, and some of them were not. But they are, you know, approaching the last part of their career.
Exactly.
So it was kind of a challenging situation where try to put everything together and to make everybody understand that, first of all, we had to be patient because this is a very demanding competition, and teams and players, even maybe with less talent or less skills, but who have been in the competition for more years, they know probably at the beginning better than us what it takes to succeed, especially the idea that every possession, not every game, every possession counts.
That's my favorite saying on TV. I'm like, forget every game. This is every possession you're in these games.
I can't agree more. But at the same time, to be ambitious and to say, hey, let's stretch this the more we can. Let's see where we can get. Let's where this can bring us. Nothing is against to be a really good team in the first year. So it's a kind of a double direction, right? At the same time, have the right patience in terms of understanding and making the right steps in the right timing. At the same time, don't slow down. If you have a chance to win a game more, let's win a game more and keep working, keep growing, keep making our young players grow, keep our squeeze the best juice out of our veterans until the very end and try to put together a decent competitive unit.
I have to say, I pride myself on my work. I pride myself on being like in tune with everything, making sure I know everything before I sit down with somebody, especially with a coach, because you guys are way much more intelligent than I am. I'm just an ex-player. And last night when I was at the veterans dinner, I was talking to Geronimo, Gero. And I was like, yeah, you know, I said, I got the interview tomorrow with Sergio. And he's like, oh, he's like, and he says, he just came out with a new book. And I'm like, he what? He said, he just can't. He's like, and he looked at me, he's like, you're going to interview him tomorrow and you don't know about his new book? So I'm admitting to you that even though I did all the most research I could, I missed the fact that you just came out with a new book. Is it only in Spanish? Is Spanish Italian? Is it like easily? Because he told me, he's like, you should have read it if you're going to interview him. I'm like, man, dude, I don't have that much time in my life.
It is not going to become a Pulitzer Prize. Don't worry about it. So, no, it was just an idea. Which spent my last year in the NBA was a guy who was a former student of my dad back in time who proposed me to, you know, it was making all the researches to help my memory to dig into things and stories and them. And he was sending me, you know, bullets. And now I was actually recording some voice messages, whatever. I was writing it in text. I was correcting them. And then the chapter was done, and we did it in Italian 1 year. And then, you know, they got it in Spain, and they saw it, they liked it, and said, okay, let's translate it. We had then one more chapter, actually last season, with the you know, Supercopa and the Eurocup or whatever. And then and it came out in Spanish last fall, in October, I think. Well, still in fall. And that's it. I mean, it's was fun, was not too heavy, because that was the way I did it. So it was not like I would ever sit down and write on by myself. Absolutely. I promise not to do any more, because I mean, my writing experience is done with it.
Well, I'm expecting a signed copy sometime soon. I want a little dedication with a signed copy.
I will.
A lot of people don't know this, or they might not know this, but our wives are obviously good friends. They've known each other for years, and I've known Blanca forever. You know, for anybody who doesn't know this, who's listening or watching the podcast, Blanca was one of the best female basketball players I've ever seen. So not only did you coach basketball your whole life, you married into basketball also, even though she retired quite early. But how much easier does that make it for you as a coach to be married to somebody who understands the rigors of being a professional basketball player?
During many years of my career, was extremely helpful, and because I was never, not like you guys, I was never a superstar to say it in a nice way. I could never think and feel like a superstar thinks and feel. And this is absolutely, it's impossible, right? You have a different way of, more of a team player, more of a coach, like a teacher. And that helped me a lot to understand, even to understand what I didn't like,
right,
of this kind of players, right? And honestly, it was extremely, extremely helpful, because I didn't have at all that vision, that part of a vision of a top talented player who are so gifted that can absorb a lot of usage, a lot of possessions. And then, you know, at some point, she became kind of basketball is my enemy, because it's taking my husband off me. There was so many hours.
That was my next question. So you're segueing for me.
Yeah. But now we found a kind of a balance where she can travel when I am out on a road trip, or we have, my son is playing in SEA, so she can go visit him, or my daughter is studying in Madrid, so go visit him, or we should go to Marbella to her family, whatever. So, I mean, we are finding a good way to make it work. And I think we found a good balance right now. But there was time where it was honestly tough. And honestly, I can understand why so many of my colleagues get divorced at some point. This is sad, but this is what happened. Because this profession, this job is really, as you said, you don't have someone who really loves, understands this, and even like that, something at some point will get you in trouble, right? It's not gonna be possible, because it's really a 24/7, I would say 365, and especially for someone like me who has two jobs. This is still the big domestic issue. I mean, okay, they have their team, but then they have 2 months in summer. They have, you know, and I had not, but for a couple of more years, it's going to be like this, and then we'll see what the future will bring us.
Yeah, well, you tell Black, I don't watch you guys suffer, but I don't see her suffer very often on their Instagram all over, like, you know, in Madrid with her friends.
I told you, she found the balance.
Yeah, exactly. She found the balance.
Definitely.
The last thing for me, well, two last things, family. You talked about your son who's playing basketball now, Alexandro. what's that like for you? I mean, he's been in the U.S. playing at a Baptist university in Arkansas, I believe, right?
Yep.
And is that, I mean, do you watch video of him? Do you critique him?
Well, I watch games.
Right.
But I'm very, very cautious in making observations. Mm-hmm. First of all, because I might not control every single part of what they, you know, their exactly. philosophy, their coach. Actually, his head coach is Dennis Nutt. I don't know if you remember.
Oh, my God, yeah, I remember Dennis Nutt.
He played for Real Madrid with George Carr back in time. And he was teammate of Isba Santos at the same time. So right. What's the funny story right there?
Dennis played in, did he play in BYU, I think, Brigham Young?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
He was an incredible shooter.
Great shooter, yeah.
Yeah, great shooter.
So he is a very good coach, and but at the same time, he is an NCAA coach. So with different personnel, different goal, different. So I want to be very respectful of my colleague. At the same time, I don't want to be the typical, because I've seen so many of those terrible example of head coaches, former players, dead like pain. When I see them, I feel ashamed for that. You know, I don't want to be, of course, not in the stands, right? But not even at home, not even phone calls. If he asked me, now he got the maturity level where he's asking me, and I will give him my opinion. But I try to give him my opinion as a coach, not as a dad. Because as a dad, I would be, sure, I'm biased. And I would probably be a little bit more biased in terms of, come on, you can do more. You can, why you did that? Why you did that?
Not pushing.
Yeah, I try to stay away from it. And say, listen, this is my opinion. I don't know if it's what you guys do. According to what I understood now, that is your coach philosophy. And it's you get the maturity point. I'm very proud because he made his way into an NCAA team with becoming a starter, becoming 22, 23 minutes per game player. With he's doing his role and. Without any help, without any push, without any specific reason to be there instead of other guys. So next year he will probably come back from there. He will get a degree, will come back, and we'll see where his basketball career will professional basketball career will start from.
In the long run, it's experience that he has, those 4 years of being there. That's I think the most important thing.
Definitely,
But the last thing before we go to our EuroLeague test is I was just thinking to myself, I'm like, well, if you and your wife are having some sort of, you know, issues with the coaching, the national team, whatever, you know, you could always tell her that, you know, if I give up this, I'm going to go into acting because, you know, you did see me in Hustle, right?
Well, actually, listen, they paid us a beautiful family vacation 4 days. In Palma de Mallorca on a boat. Actually, the only 4 days we could be together, it was an Olympic year. So I had only 4 days, and they organized a beautiful vacation for us. And I had one day, shooting those couple of scenes. One of those end up in the final version. And hanging in with Adam Sandler, which is an unbelievable basketball guy. He knows everything.
Yeah.
Plays basketball, he likes to play. He had a lot of questions. He's so curious. It was a great experience. It was fun. I mean, Juancho was the star, of course. We all knew it, but it was nice. It was different. It was fun.
Well, see, when you have a problem with that, Blanco, just say, hey, Joe told me I can go to Hollywood and become a major actor.
Yeah,
so, you know, choose between whichever one you want.
The crossover test.
All right, Coach, it's test time, and we'll get you out of here so you can go enjoy your family for Christmas and the holidays. All right, this is a EuroLeague test. Every time I do this, I always forget who's up there, but Dante Exum had the 100 points. And I had a couple last year, but This is this year. 5 questions. First question is worth 10 points. Second one is 20. Third, 30. Fourth, 40. Fifth, 50. Obviously, they get more and more difficult. All right, here we go. For 10 points, who was last year's Final Four MVP?
Misich.
See how easy that is? We always take it easy in the beginning. That's 10 points for you. Question number 2, worth 20 points. How many games can a team play in this EuroLeague season?
41.
There you go. Very good. That was pretty quick. That's 30 quick points. Let me see. Next one. Who won the first finals MVP in the modern EuroLeague era?
Wow.
You were there. I mean, you were there. That was you coached the first game of the season.
First
so.
Game. No, the last one, unfortunately. Well, that was the year of Panathinaikos and Maccabi were not team. Were in the so-called Super League. It was 2001, 2002, right?
2000, 2001.
2000, 2001.
I'm getting messages that I can tell you who won it. Not who won the MVP, but what team won it.
Tell me who won.
Virtus Bologna.
So, Manu Ginobili.
There you go. I don't know, man. Hey, this is coming from Pablo from EuroLeague, so I gave you the hint. I usually don't give hints. You got it. All right, next question worth 40 points. So you're up to 60. Who are the 3 coaches with the most games won in EuroLeague history?
Well, I would say Jelko.
That's one.
Ettore.
That's 2. You're missing 1.
Third one. Duda.
Xavi Pascual.
Oh, Xavi. Happy.
Xavi.
He made it.
Xavi, 2 out of 41.
Oh, excellent.
All right, now here's an important question because it's worth 50. So you still have a chance to take the lead with 110 points if you answer this next question. Question number 5. Which country has had more different teams playing in EuroLeague history since the start of the modern era?
Can be tricky, right? Or not?
I wouldn't have gotten it.
Can it be tricky or
not? I wouldn't have gotten the answer. And I just got a message from Pablo EuroLeague who said, no hints on this one. We said we already gave you the 30 points for free. So
no, come on, for free. That's a 50. This point cannot be Spain, because it would be easy. Or Germany. Because Italy had a few different. Russia had a few. Greece had a few.
Should I do that? Ding, 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 ding,
yeah,
ding,
yeah,
ding,
yeah.
Ding, ding. I can't give any hints.
Okay. So let's see.
This is for the all-time lead. This is for the most points ever in the EuroLeague history, in the EuroLeague test exam, so I can't give any hints.
I don't know. Greece?
Man, you should have went with the country that you were born in, my man.
Oh, really?
And you said it. There were 12, and that 12 teams altogether.
Yeah.
And I asked them before when they sent me the question. I'm like, does he have to name all 12 teams? That's going to be impossible.
Well, I might.
Anyway, I'll tell you what. We'll give you some extra points if you name all 12.
Well, let's stop. But 2 Bologna, Milan, Treviso, Siena. Why get to 12? With the modern EuroLeague, you mean, right?
Modern EuroLeague, yeah.
Wow. But no, I can't.
Coach, number one is thank you so much again for taking the time. I really appreciate you doing this. It's been 5 years of like learning so much from talking to different people, and I've learned obviously a lot from you. I wish you and the family obviously happy holidays. You told me before the show, this is between us, no one's gonna hear it, that you didn't mind taking a couple hours to spend with me today to get away from the house for a little while. I'll get you in trouble one way or the other. Coach, it's been a real pleasure. Next time you're in Madrid, look me up, and love to get down, sit down and chat with you a little bit more.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you so much for your time and your honesty.
Sure. Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas. If you like what you've heard, subscribe now so you don't miss an episode, and leave us a review on iTunes and Apple Podcasts. You can also get in touch via Twitter and Instagram at EuroLeague using the hashtag ELCrossover, or on Facebook at the EuroLeague.